Now I'm here and we're ready and good to go. Good morning, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for coming out to learn together. And thank you to Rabbi Milevsky and the B'nai Torah community for hosting this event. It's really wonderful to see you all here. So we are reading in these weeks about the tremendous moment at Ma'amad Har Sinai, where we come to Mount Sinai and we receive the Torah and we make this incredible brit, this agreement with God, that we're going to be his people, and he's going to be our God. We're going to follow his ways, we're going to follow his laws and his Torah. And in this upcoming week's parsha, we make a tremendous statement, one that is incredibly famous and incredibly discussed. And that phrase is the two words, Na'aseh V'Nishma. We're going to discuss today and explore what these words can mean, what these words can tell us about our Jewish experience. And I propose that just in these two words alone, they can provide the blueprint for us, or they do provide the blueprint for us of our entire Jewish experience. And they really frame for us the tensions in our religious experience and the dualities that are there. So let's begin with source number one. So in Shemot, Perek Kaf Dalet, is where we see this phrase, Na'aseh V'Nishma. And if you don't know yet what these words mean, that is not a problem, because this is exactly what we're going to discuss. So in Pasuk Gimel, Vayavo Moshe Vayisaper La'am Et Kol Diver Hashem Ve'et Kol Mishpatim Vaya'an Kol Ha'am Kol Achad Vayomer Kol Advarim Asher Diver Hashem Na'aseh. So Moshe comes and he tells the people all of the words of God and all the laws. And the entire nation responds and they say, Na'aseh, we will do this. And then a few verses later, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, Vayikach Sefer HaBrit, Vayikra Bozne Ha'am. Moshe takes the book of the covenant and he reads it to the nation, Vayomru Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma. And they respond back, everything that Hashem says, Na'aseh, we will do, V'Nishma, and we will hear. And it's those two words alone, Na'aseh V'Nishma, that I want to unpack with us today. And we're going to explore a number of different approaches. Before we really get into the various approaches, I want to show you just a source that highlights the significance of this phrase. In source number two, the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, Daf Peichet Amud Aleph, Tractate Shabbat 88a, discusses what happened in this moment when B'nai Yisrael, when the people of Israel said, Na'aseh V'Nishma. So let's start reading source number two. Amar Rabbi Elazar, B'sha'a shehekdimo Yisrael na'aseh l'nishma, yatzta ba'kol v'amra lehen, mikila libanai razeh shemalachei hasharet mishtamshim bo. B'resha asi v'hadar lishma. Rabbi Elazar is saying that in this moment, when B'nai Yisrael said na'aseh before nishma, a heavenly voice came out and said, who revealed to my children the secret of the angels? Now, why is this a secret of the angels? The Gemara says, because the angels, they do na'aseh before they hearken, before they hear. So the Gemara is explaining for us that this order is particularly significant. The fact that B'nai Yisrael said, first we will do, and then we will listen. One more comment in the Gemara that we're going to explore before really getting into particular approaches. Amar Rabbi Chama b'Rabbi Chanina, my dichtiv kitapuch batzeh ha'yar v'gomer. So Rabbi Chama quotes from a verse from Song of Songs, and it talks about an apple tree. And the rabbis say that the Song of Songs is really a metaphor for the people of Israel. And so he asks, Lama nimshilu Yisrael etapuch? Why are the people of Israel compared to an apple? Because an apple tree, its fruit grows before its leaves. I was not aware of this. I'm not an expert in how fruit trees grow, but according to Rabbi Chama, he said that an apple tree, the fruit grows before the leaves, which is not the typical way that plants usually produce. And so that is the same as Na'aseh V'Nishma, that there's Na'aseh, there's doing before listening. Now, we still haven't yet explained what does it mean to do here and what does it mean to listen. Before we go into our particular approaches, I want to just ask you, and feel free to make this as interactive as we would like. Does anybody have thoughts, or maybe you've learned this idea before? What does Na'aseh Nishma mean? Right? Maybe something you've learned before, or just reading these sources already giving us a taste of what is happening here. What is so significant that this is the secret of the angels that they do before they hear? What does this mean? Any thoughts before we dive in? Feel free to just speak up if you have an idea.
That they trusted whatever God had told them without any explanation.
Okay, so we're going to see that approach next. That they just accepted. They said, we will do whatever you say. We don't have to understand it. We don't need an explanation. We're just going to do as you say. That is a perfect segue to our first approach, which is probably, and from my experience, the most common way of explaining this phrase. Let's look at source number three. And many people state this idea, but I quoted for you where it was particularly clear from the Akedat Yitzchak, which is a commentary by Rabbi Yitzchak Arama. He's a Spanish commentator from, I believe, the 14th or 15th century. He is 15th century Spain. And this is how he explains Na'aseh Benishma. Na'aseh bibchinat ha-koach ha-gufani sheshlemuto be-poal mergash. That Na'aseh is referring to physical abilities, to actually doing something, to actually taking tangible action. Benishma bibchinat ha-koach ha-sikhli. And Nishma is then the intellectual. And so there's I think this is what, remind me, who just shared that idea? Because not everyone's video is on.
Gabby.
Oh, Gabby. Okay. Thank you, Gabby. That there is the idea of doing before understanding, before intellectual understanding. What I would say that this is in a way the duality between obedience, right, versus intellectual understanding, or action versus intellectual understanding. And that is what B'nai Israel did. That was, in a way, the secret of the angels, and that was praiseworthy. I would like to, according to this approach, that B'nai Israel began with doing, and then later they said, we will intellectually understand. I want to just sidetrack for a moment and throw out the question of, in our Avodat Hashem, in our worship of God, what do we think is the ideal? Is it ideal to say we are going to act without understanding, or is it ideal to understand what we're doing in our practice of Judaism? I throw out the question to you. What do you think is the ideal, which is the final goal? Which are we striving for? Which is more meaningful? Open question, feel free to shout out.
I would think probably understanding, because that would kind of help you to continue doing what you're doing because you understand it.
Okay. So you think that a higher level of worshiping God is understanding why we do what we do. Does anyone want to agree or disagree?
I think that there's God already has a set of beings that are perfectly obedient, which is the angels. So we have to find a different niche. The downside of understanding is that we are then able to rationalize disobedience by saying, oh, well, it's not my particular case that fits that particular idea.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that it is the ideal to intellectually understand, but there is a danger in that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other thoughts or comments on this duality between doing versus understanding?
Maybe we are supposed to do whatever we're told to do, but we should also spend our lives trying to understand more deeply what we do and why.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this, in fact, is a debate that is has been going on for centuries within Jewish thinkers, particularly in the area of Tamei HaMitzvot, of understanding the reasons for the laws. There are some thinkers who say we should strive to understand them. We should strive to explain them. For example, Maimonides, he tries to give reasons for the mitzvot. But there are others who say no, because if you try to understand them, then you're not as obedient. There's a higher level of relationship where you don't need to intellectually understand it, and you're doing it because you have that relationship, because you're just trusting. It's pure trust. And so there are really these two sides. And I think even in our world today, there are people who would feel more connected to one approach, more connected to the other approach. I want to share with you Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, the former Rosh Yeshiva at Har Tzion, who has his perspective, which I think is in line with many of you. But again, this is really only one side of this debate. In source number 4, he discusses the idea of Na'aseh V'Nishma, working with this interpretation that it's based on actions, almost trusting blindly versus intellectually understanding. And he says in source number 4, admittedly, the Torah requires that a person sacrifice not only an offering, but sometimes also his human intelligence and understanding on the altar of Torah observance. It is inconceivable that a person might perform only those commandments that he understands, or only those to which he accedes. Shane, I think this is what you were referring to. Ultimately, however, what God desires is not blind obedience, but rather that we understand and internalize the values that underlie his commandments. The level of understanding that is required of each person has been subject to debate throughout the generations, as reflected, for example, in the controversy over finding reasons for the mitzvot. Ultimately, though, we accept that God is not looking for robots to serve him. Rather, he seeks true servants who serve him out of an understanding and internalization of his values. Not only shall we do, but also we shall hear. I think this is echoing what many of you already shared, that we are obedient to God and we do trust blindly in a way. However, we seek to understand and we try to understand. The higher level is trying to understand. And this is, you know, not a simple relationship between those two, but that is the concept of Na'aseh V'Nishma. This wraps up our first approach. Any comments or thoughts before we move on to a different approach to Na'aseh V'Nishma? Yeah, Claudette.
Isn't it wise to engage the intellect so that we can grow? Because if we understand what we are doing, there is growth. It's good to believe, an initial belief, but I think we need to engage the intellect in this.
I think that is very much in line, again, with Rav Lichtenstein. I will say, though, that there are a lot of thinkers who would really think otherwise, that intellect is lower level, and what is beyond that, what is beyond the intellect, is almost higher. And so it's really interesting that people come at this from their very different perspectives. But thank you, Claudette. Any other comments or questions on this before moving on?
Yeah, just one thing. We're specifically given some mitzvot for which we know there is no rational explanation, like Parah Aduma, like the other chukim. So obviously that element has to exist, even if we can understand and intellectualize many of the others.
Okay, so what you're saying is there's always going to be a level of blind obedience.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's tension here, because no one lives completely in one or the other. No one lives completely in blind obedience or completely in understanding everything. We're somewhere in the middle, and we're constantly going back and forth between these two. Beautiful point. All right, let's move on now to source number 5. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, Zatzal, provides a little bit of a different spin. And he accepts the idea that Na'aseh is doing, but then he gives a bit of a different approach to what Nishma is, to what the next level is. Source number 5. The modern Western mind tends to put things in the opposite order. We seek to understand what we are committing ourselves to before making the commitment. That is fine when what is at stake is signing a contract, buying a new mobile phone, or purchasing a subscription, but not when making a deep existential commitment. The only way to understand leadership is to lead. The only way to understand marriage is to get married. The only way to understand whether a certain career path is right for you is to actually try it for an extended period. Those who hover on the edge of a commitment, reluctant to make a decision until all the facts are in, will eventually find that life has passed them by. The only way to understand a way of life is to take the risk of living it. So Nasava Nishma, we will do, and eventually, through extended practice and long exposure, we will understand. Rabbi Sacks is also emphasizing that we will understand later, but it's not intellectual, it's experiential. We will understand by actually living the mitzvot, by actually living your ways, God, and we will understand it because we will experience it. That is how we will truly understand. And this idea, I think, is in a way familiar to us, that this is how many of us experience Judaism. If we're raised in Judaism as children, we don't study the laws as children, we live them as children. And then when we're older, we can come to understand them, but we really understand in a way by just living them, right? And in a way, that's really how we understand many things in life, by experiencing it. We do it, and then afterwards we understand it because we've experienced it, and now we know what it means. And this can be extended, I believe, to a further idea that is made famous by the Sefer HaChinuch, source number 6. It's a famous idea. Sefer HaChinuch was a commentary on the Torah that identifies all the laws that come out from the Torah and explains them. And he, in Law 16, he discusses a principle, an operating principle for him. Da. Ki ha'adam nif'al kefi pe'ulotav, libo v'chol machshavotav tamid achar ma'asav shehu oseg behem, im tov ve'im ra. So a person's thoughts and his heart will follow his actions. Va'afilo rasha gamor bilvavo v'chol yetzer machshavot libo rak kol hayom, im ya'arev ruchlo v'yasim hishtadlito v'asako b'hi nada b'tor mitzvot, va'afilo shalo l'shem shamayim, miyad yinata al hatov, mitok shalo l'shma ba l'shma, v'koch ma'asav yamid ha'yetzer hara. Saying if somebody has evil intentions, evil thoughts, but they start to do positive actions, they start to fulfill Torah and mitzvot, their thoughts will start to change. And their yetzer hara, their evil inclination, will in fact decrease. Ki acharei ha-pe'ulot nimshachim ha-levavot. I underline the key phrase. The heart follows the actions a person does. And so Sefer HaChinuch is really emphasizing the same idea, that we first take action, and then our heart follows. And I think this really dovetails with Rabbi Sacks's idea that our heart, we experience in a way, is represented by our heart, our feelings about it, that really follows the action that we take. I want to just finalize this idea with one more thought, and then we'll hear comments or questions on this interpretation. Source number 7, this is just a modern psychology article, Dr. Noam Spencer, but he talks about the same idea, but from a modern psychology lens. Many people assume that the link between emotion and behavior is one way. Emotions shape behavior. You love him, therefore you kiss him. You hate him, therefore you hit him. This view is incorrect. In fact, the relationship is reciprocal. Much of the time, behavior actually shapes emotions. Ever wonder why so often the actor and actress who play a couple in a movie fall in love on the set? Multiple processes are involved, be sure. Both are usually young and attractive. They have much in common. They hang around each other a lot. All these are known predictors of mate selection, but they also do love scenes together. They have to act like people who care deeply for each other. They look into each other's eyes. They touch each other. They act out the behavior of love. No wonder the emotion of love often follows. Behavior can create emotions. Recent research in clinical psychology has shown that the fastest way to change an emotion is to change the behavior attached to it. So Nasa Venishma is about doing, and then the emotion, the experience follows, and that's what allows us to really understand it, by having the emotions follow after the actions. Any thoughts, questions, responses to this additional way of understanding Nasa Venishma?
I would like to say I agree with Rabbi Sacks, what he said, but I still think that we may make that initial move towards, say, marriage. But when we get into it, we have to put in the work. And to put in the work, we have to bring our every sense into that marriage, which means we have to learn what makes that marriage work. It's like Judaism. I think studying the word makes growth in us as Jews.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is you have to commit, but then you have to recommit constantly and commit to learning and studying.
And studying, because otherwise you will grow. It's like a child. If you teach a child something to do and the child does it, eventually the child grows up and needs to understand why it's doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think what you're almost joining together our two approaches. Saying that you need to commit in order to experience and understand it, but you also need to apply your intellect.
Put the work into
as well.
It. Yeah.
It's the concept of Nasa Benishma Nasa.
What do you mean?
Do it, then learn more about it, understand it, and then you'll do it.
And grow.
Nasa will be even different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Shana, did you want to share something? I see you posted. Park a block away.
Just that the people who do the act without the intent, I think they're susceptible to the charge of being hypocritical. You don't really mean it. You're just doing it so that we can see you do it or so that you can fit in. And you have no genuine intent in doing it.
For sure. This is a difficult concept. I don't know exactly in what situations we can really apply it. I think there's definitely truth to it, but I think what you're saying is also correct that it depends maybe how the person is doing it. If they're doing it just for external recognition, then that might not necessarily lead to any internal feeling.
My father, Alava Shalom, used to say he was a big fan of hypocrisy because it meant that people knew what they should be doing. They weren't actually there yet, but they knew what they should be doing.
Listen, the first level is always awareness, for sure. So,
I think Shabbat is a great example of something where if you just heard all the rules and restrictions, you go, get me out of here, right? Like, it sounds horrendous. But if you actually experience a Shabbat, you start to love it, and then the rules don't become burdensome at all.
Mm-hmm. That is a perfect example. That it's really hard to explain what Shabbat is like until you live it. It really is.
Experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our third approach. Oh, yeah, someone else wanted to say something?
I think also if you start doing something, even if you do it for the wrong reasons, like just so that people will see what you're doing or something like that, after you've been doing it for a while, then you get to appreciate it and do it for the right reasons.
So even if you do it for others, you still might be able to find meaning in it eventually.
Yeah.
And it might become meaningful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Definitely. All right, let's move on to source number three, approach number three, source number eight. And this is also an idea from Rabbi Sachs, but it's a little bit of a different approach of the duality between Naseh and Nishma. He frames it a little bit differently here. Judaism is a community of doing rather than of hearing. There is an authoritative code of Jewish law. When it comes to halakha, the way of Jewish doing, we seek consensus. By contrast, though, there are undoubtedly principles of Jewish faith. When it comes to spirituality, there is no single normative Jewish approach. Judaism has had its priests and prophets, its rationalists and mystics, its philosophers and poets. Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, speaks in a multiplicity of voices. There are norms about how to act as Jews, but there are few about how to think and feel as Jews. We experience God in different ways. We can find God on the heights and in the depths, in loneliness and togetherness, in love and fear, in gratitude and need, in dazzling light, and in the midst of deep darkness. That is the difference between Na'asa and Nishma. We do the godly deed together. We respond to his commands with one voice, but we hear God's presence in many ways. For though God is one, we are all different, and we encounter him each in our own way. So Rabbi Sachs is still looking at Nasa as the action, as the actions that we take, but he's focusing on the fact that our actions are communal. Our actions have consensus. We act as one for the most part. Obviously, there are different practices in different communities, but for the most part, our legal code is is widely agreed upon. It's meant to be universal. It's meant to be that everyone is doing something relatively consistent, right? We all pray using, by and large, the same text. We, by and large, practice in the same way. However, how we feel about that, what we think about that, that is open to interpretation, and that is open to the individual to find meaning in that and to relate to it in the way that he or she finds most meaningful. There are a couple, but there are very few places or sources that really tell us what to think and what to feel. We mostly focus on how to act, but then the rest is left to the individual. So it's this duality between being a part of the community, but also practicing in your own way. Also bringing your avodah Hashem, your worship Hashem, into yourself and really looking internally as well. Again, a different duality here between Na'aseh and Nishma. And Rabbi Sacks actually looks at the verses where Na'aseh v'Nishma comes up for evidence. If you look back to source number one, the people of Israel first say, Na'aseh, we will do. And it's interesting that in verse three, it says, Vayan kol ha'am kol echad. The people said in one voice, Na'aseh, in one voice, we will do, right? Highlighting that there's consensus. We will act in the same way. But with Na'aseh v'Nishma, it doesn't say that they said it in one voice. And the point here is that there is no one voice about Nishma, about really understanding it, because that is up to you as an individual. And that there really is room for the individual to make his or own meaning in a certain way. Responses, thoughts, questions? Okay, let's move on to our last two approaches. Approach number four is source number nine. And this is from the writings of Rav Kook. It's a translation a collection of his writings or his ideas by Rabbi Hanan Morrison. And Rav Kook was a major figure in the land of Israel, the chief rabbi, living in the, I believe, early 1900s. And he really was a major thinker, but he bent more mystical. And we'll see that in his approach here to what Na'aseh v'Nishma means. So source number nine. What was so special about this vow, we will do, we will listen? On the contrary, would not fulfilling mitzvah with understanding and enlightenment be a superior level of Torah observance? And why does the Midrash refer to this form of unquestioning allegiance as a secret used by the angels? While wisdom is usually acquired through study and contemplation, there exists in nature an intuitive knowledge that requires no formal education. The bee, for example, naturally knows the optimal geometric shape for building honeycomb cells. No bee has ever needed to register for engineering courses at MIT. Intuitive knowledge also exists in the spiritual realm. Angels are sublime spiritual entities who do not require extensive Torah study in order to know how to serve God. Their holiness is ingrained in their very nature. It is only human beings, prone to being confused by pseudoscientific indoctrination, who need to struggle in order to return their pristine spiritual selves. For the Jews who stood at Mount Sinai, it was not only Torah and mitzvot that were revealed. They also discovered their own true inner essence. They attained a sublime level of natural purity and intuitively proclaimed, we will do. We will follow our natural essence unhindered by any spurious artificial conventions. So Rav Kook is highlighting that there's one level of artificial in a way, but external practice, looking outside of yourself to connect to God, looking towards the structure of our religion, towards a community, towards other people. But then there's also an internal spiritual realm that he believes we all naturally have inside of us. It's inherent to being a human being. It's right, connected to the sense that we are created in the image of God. We are created with B'Tzelem Elohim. And so we have this natural sense and we know how to connect to God. But the trouble is that we don't always feel connected to that knowledge. It's a deep intuitive knowledge. And so for him, the first level is looking outside of ourselves, looking to the artificial, to the external. But then the next level is looking inside of ourselves, connecting to that inherent spirituality that is within all of us. And you see here, this is very different than our previous approaches, where it's not focusing on the intellect as the goal. It's really focusing on intuitive knowledge, on inherent spirituality that is not boiled down necessarily to intellect, and it's not found outside of ourselves. It's really just found by connecting deeply within our spiritual selves. Any responses or thoughts on this more mystical approach?
I believe that we have, human beings have all of those two, the two different approach is how we tap into it.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I'm just puzzled why they were so caught up in this rapture of Na'aseh v'Nishma, but then they end up, you know, breaking the laws. So what happened?
Okay. So what you're asking is, how did the people of Israel make this agreement with God, this covenant, and then it seems like they broke it? That's really your question?
Yes. You know, again, if they were caught up with so much spirituality, then why very soon after they were breaking the laws? And they lost their confidence.
Yeah, and it's to add to your point, even at Mount Sinai, that happened with the sin of the golden calf, with Chedah Evel, where they lost that connection. And it's a great question. Answer is that I think that this is really reflects human nature and our experience with God, that we have moments of closeness and moments of distance, and we're dynamic and we're always changing, and we can feel something at one moment, but we don't always feel that. And I think we could probably all relate to that idea, that we might really make a strong commitment to ourselves, and it's very hard to keep that all the time, because we're always changing and our circumstances are always changing and our feelings are always changing. And so it's difficult to always maintain that. And in a way, the greater the commitment, the greater the struggle to maintain it. So that is definitely a challenge, but I think that's constantly our mission. And that actually brings me perfectly to our last approach. If you look at source number 10, Rashbam, who was a commentator on Torah and Talmud, but his living in the 12th century in France. And he gives what seems to be a very simple approach to Na'aseh v'Nishma. What he says is, Na'aseh v'Nishma, Na'aseh ma shediber, v'gam nishma ma shetzavenu ol mikanu laba v'nikayim. We will do what you already commanded to us, and we'll continue to obey what you command to us in the future. Which sounds very simple, right? It doesn't sound at first glance particularly deep, but I think that we can really understand this in a much deeper way. And I'll share with you the approach explained by Rabbi Yaakov Beasley, who, let's read this first paragraph and we'll see how he really fleshes out what Rashbam could be saying in source number 11. When the Jewish people stated, "We shall do and we shall hear," they expressed a desire to go beyond the simple fulfillment of the commandments. Na'aseh, we shall do, alone. Nishma, we shall hear, meant that they would hold themselves ready at all times for further revelations or understandings of what God wanted. They would commit themselves to listening for not how to perform the commandments, but also how to ensure that their performance of the commandments corresponded to God's will. So it's not just that they would practice what they learned and continue to practice, but what he's saying is that they would constantly check themselves and they would constantly think and re-question, are we in line with what God really wants? Because it's easy to just say, I'm going to do this, and then never think more about it, never think more, and never reassess. But what he's saying is they're going to constantly reassess and constantly strive to maintain that connection and to maintain the ultimate goal of keeping God's will. Not just doing these actions, but the ultimate, beyond that goal, of course, really following God's will. And Rabbi Beasley actually shares the approach of Rav Nachman of Breslov, a Hasidic master, who goes a little bit in this direction, interestingly. And he says in the second paragraph in source number 11, as a person grows spiritually, what was once hidden from him, Nishma, becomes revealed, Na'aseh. Yet simultaneously, a new area of hiddenness emerges before him. Again, the constant quest for growth, the desire to reveal the hidden truths that permeate our relationship with God, become embodied within the Jew's faculty of hearing. This desire to encounter both the revealed and the hidden becomes the hallmark of the Jew who proudly states Na'aseh v'nishma. So the duality here is between Na'aseh, something that's revealed, something that we already know to be true, but Nishma is now going beyond that, exploring the hiddenness, exploring what we don't yet understand, exploring what feels beyond our grasp. And that's a constant activity, because something is revealed and something is hidden, and then we understand the hidden, and now we move another level to something further that was not understood to us before. We're constantly growing. It's an endless cycle of traveling from the revealed to the hidden, and then creating new layers of revealed and hidden. So this wraps up our five different approaches. I want to just conclude by highlighting what we see here, that there are so many ways of understanding the phrase Na'aseh v'nishma. I only chose a sampling of five, but I think that it's so interesting because it really, in a way, captures for us what we do and what we're trying to do in Judaism, what it's really all about. On the one hand, we have this duality between action and an intellectual understanding that we do, and then we try to understand it intellectually. And I think we all relate to that, right? That constant tension. We also have the tension, the duality between commitment, committing to something, and then later experiencing it, right? Committing, experiencing, deciding to do it, and then actually feeling what that's like, constantly back and forth. The third duality is the sense of community versus the individual, that we are constantly jostling between those. We are part of this larger community. We practice as a community, but we also have our individual experience and our individual relationship to what we do. The fourth duality that I think we see here is the external practice of our Judaism. And then there's the internal, that inherent natural spirituality that we have inside of us, the internal, where we have this duality between looking externally to connect to God, and then also looking internally. And the last duality we see here is what's revealed and what's understood, and then also what's hidden, and striving to understand what's hidden. And the questions that this really begs us to think about is, what is the blueprint that we are currently using in our worship of God? And what is the blueprint that we want to be using? What are we striving for? What duality is most meaningful for us? And what duality is most present in our lives? But also, what duality do we feel really is the essence, in a way, of our practice of God? It doesn't have to be only one. I think Na'aseh v'nishma is so open to interpretation because there are so many different ways of creating that blueprint, of finding those dualities in our lives. There are so many dualities that exist in our worship of God. And so this just forces us to pause and to think for a moment. What are those tensions in my religious worship? What am I constantly jostling between? What is a community are we constantly jostling between? Where should we find ourselves, right, on a continuum of one extreme to the other extreme? These are questions that we're constantly grappling with. But I think that understanding the phrase Na'aseh v'nishma gives us a bit more of a framework for how to think about those questions. Any final thoughts, questions, suggestions? Okay, well, I'll wrap up, and I want to thank you all for coming out to learn this morning. It was a pleasure to learn with you, to hear your ideas and thoughts. For those of you I haven't met in person, I hope to one day meet you in person, but it's really a pleasure to be here and to learn with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Much to think about. Thank you.